Association for Psychological Science recently did a review of that scientific literature and concluded that there actually is no such thing as learning styles. It, you know, it's popular, but it's not really, the scientific evidence isn't there. So if there aren't learning styles to begin with, there really can't be differences between boys and girls' learning styles. So there really just is not evidence that that's correct.
You know, speaking from a constructionist sociological standpoint, doesn't that also sort of point to the idea that these concepts of gender that we have might not be scientifically as correct as we might think they are?
Oh, that's right. A lot of this is about stereotypes and a lot of the arguments about boys and girls learning differently, and they have no basis whatsoever in science. For example, one of these things that's proposed by advocates of single-sex education is that boys like competitive learning environments and girls are just terrified about competition, and you have to have them in a very cooperative learning environment. I will tell you, if you'll pardon the anecdote, when I was a kid, we used to play competitive math games in my third grade classroom because nobody had started making these silly proposals then, and I loved competitions in math, and here I was a girl. So the point is that maybe some girls prefer competition, maybe some don't, maybe some boys don't like competition. So why would you sort the kids according to gender? There's so many differences from one boy to the next and from one girl to the next.
I bet you won a lot of those competitions, didn't you?
Math is one of my favorite topics.
So the last sort of argument for same-sex education is that everybody deserves a choice and that some people, they just might do better in these kinds of atmospheres. What's your counter-argument to that?
Choice is a popular word in the United States, but I think that this argument does not bear close scrutiny. Would we, for example, apply this to race? So would we say, okay, all you white parents, if you prefer your kids to be just in all-white classrooms with no ethnic minority kids, and that should be your choice, would we allow that? I don't think so, you know, because we understand that racial segregation is wrong. We wouldn't offer that as a choice. Why should we offer that as a choice in the case of gender? Why should we say if parents prefer their kids to be in single-sex classrooms? And the other thing, of course, is that, you know, parents want the best for their kids. That goes without saying. But often they aren't informed about what the scientific data show about various educational methods.
And Dr. Hyde, we've talked about some of the counter-arguments to the anecdotal evidence that is often presented for the case for same-sex schooling, but is there anything showing that there are negative effects to same-sex schooling?
Well, the concern about single-sex schooling is that it may promote gender stereotyping and sexism. We have a lot of research in social psychology that shows if you want two groups to get along well together, whether it's blacks and whites or whether it's boys and girls, what you have to do is have them have lots of good contact with each other, and then they'll get to know each other and they'll behave better toward each other. The problem with single-sex education is that it removes that kind of contact. So what we really need to do is work on improving our co-educational classrooms, and that's what we need to work on if we want boys and girls to get along well together, if we want men and women to get along well together.
Janet Hyde, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm glad to do it.
That was Professor of Psychology and Women's Studies at UW-Madison, Dr. Janet Hyde, speaking with our very own Mark Griffin about her new study published in the Journal of Science. To read more, go to sciencemag.org. Dr. Hyde is also a board member of the American Council of Co-Educational Schooling and you can visit their website at www.coedschools.org.
This last recall summer may be an isolated event if Representative Robin Voss has anything to do with it. Yesterday, Voss introduced a constitutional amendment to limit recall elections to politicians who commit a crime or ethics violation while in office. That's opposed to recalls based on support for unpopular legislation. Opponents have derided Voss for previously supporting Democratic Party recalls and for staying silent about fake Democratic candidates before introducing the amendment. Earlier in our backyard, producer Elliot Hack spoke with Graham Zielinski, who's a communications director for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. And he talked to him about the amendment and why other legislators are having trouble understanding it.
it's totally hypocritical that this guy bought and paid for by the Koch brothers is now trying to deny democracy because people stood up to him and stood up to the Koch brothers and stood up to Scott Walker. It's part of a pattern with Republicans who are trying to squelch democracy here in Wisconsin. They want fewer people to vote. They want fewer opportunities to vote, fewer opportunities to appear on a ballot, fewer opportunities for people to express themselves publicly at the Capitol. They want fewer legislators to be able to speak, depending on the content. They want less democracy all around, and it's merely because they don't like the content. The recall option was developed by reformers here precisely because of people like Robin Voss. They knew would come down someday and propose legislation so extreme that it required a democratic solution, which is the recall movement. The bar to recall is really high. It's 25% of the vote, basically. You have to get signatures to trigger it. So if 25% of an electorate believe that there's reason to recall somebody, regardless of what Robin Voss thinks, there should be an election. This is a good tool given to us by reformers who understood that someday people like Scott Walker and Robin Voss would come along and would try to sell our state off to the Koch brothers or do great damage to our education system or end collective bargaining rights for workers and all the manner of things that required a solution. And I guess he doesn't like the results. We went on the Republican turf and won 5 of 9 elections, and we turned about 8% of that Republican electorate from red to blue. He doesn't like it. He doesn't like the correction that's going on here in Wisconsin where people are standing up to the corporate agenda of people like Robin Voss and Scott Walker. So it's totally hypocritical, by the way, for Robin Voss, because he supported recall elections of Democratic senators. He raised money for Republican recall candidates. He campaigned with Scott Walker's darling here in Milwaukee, and he said nothing when his party ran phony candidates as Democrats, which drove up the cost of the recall election, and all of a sudden this bothers him. So it's terribly hypocritical of Robin Voss. We should expect no less of the chair or one of the leaders of the ALEC organization funded by the Koch brothers, brought here to turn Wisconsin into a subsidiary of corporations and make it so that the voice of the common man and woman aren't heard. So it is a totally anti-democratic move, but we should expect this from a corporate shill like Robin Voss.
In what ways will the Constitution Amendment actually limit recall elections here in the state?
It's so badly worded. I mean, the legislation itself would mystify anyone who is interested in the Constitution or in the actual rule of law. I don't know. You'd have to ask Robin Voss what he wants to do. The bottom line is it's sour grapes because he doesn't like the results of the recall elections. He wants to change the agenda. His party has done nothing in the face of an unemployment crisis. In fact, unemployment's gone up from 7.4% to 7.9% since they've been in power here in Wisconsin. They're trying to change the discussion from their terrible record, their terrible Scott Walker budget bill. They're trying to change the subject, and with these little circus acts like this constitutional amendment, and it's not going to go anywhere. Let's be honest. This isn't going to go anywhere. This is just political grandstanding by a Koch brother shill who is willing to dance to their tune and is willing to try to change the agenda from what it really is going on in Wisconsin, which is a correction, people standing up to people like Robin Voss and Scott Walker. So his constitutional amendment is a non-starter. He knows it. He's trying to score political points at a time when people are really hurting, and they're going to be hurting even more as the full effects of Scott Walker's budget become made known.
Can you tell from the wording of the legislation whether or not situations where, like, the Wisconsin state senators that went to Illinois, would that still be a type of thing that people would be able to call recall elections for?
I don't know what his legislation does. Nobody does. It's not well-written legislation. He is not known for his leadership as a legislator or as an author of laws. He is known more for his extreme partisanship and the willingness to carry water for Scott Walker and the Koch brothers. So you'd have to ask him. I'm sure he'd be happy to tell you, but people who care about laws, who care about writing them well, who care about Wisconsin, probably wouldn't be able to divine anything from what he has submitted. This is ridiculous and selective outrage by Robin Voss. He is a shill for the Koch brothers. He's a shill for Scott Walker. He was fully part of the recall process, and for him to be shocked at costs that he helped to drive up, for him to be discouraged by the tone he helped set, for him to be going around posing for holy pictures as a reformer is total hypocrisy. And I think most people outside the kind of Republican bubble understand this and see Robin Voss for what he is. And he's just a cheap, typical politician who will say anything, do anything to get power and not to help the middle class and the working families of Wisconsin. So I think this will go away in good time, and people will realize that they've been had by this piece of legislation that's going to go nowhere.
That was In Our Backyard producer Elliot Hack speaking with Graham Zielinski, communications director for the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. We called Representative Voss' office, but they have not called back.
Wisconsin's bridges are falling down, or they might in the near future. In anticipation of President Obama's call for more investment to repair the nation's transportation infrastructure, Wisconsin Public Interest Research Group, or WISPRIG, released a report showing some alarming figures about the condition of Wisconsin bridges. Earlier today, In Our Backyard producer Elliot Hack spoke with program associate at WISPRIG, Kyle Bailey, about the data and why bridges should be repaired before new projects are undertaken.
Today, of course, President Obama was calling for some pretty robust investments in repairing our country's crumbling roads and bridges. And so, looking at that call, we released some data today that documents the number of structurally deficient bridges that are in Wisconsin. And so we broke down the data county by county, and so we found that there are a total of 1,142 bridges in the state, so one out of every 12 bridges, that are rated as structurally deficient by government standards. And additionally, even though most bridges are built to last for 50 years, 3,310 bridges in Wisconsin exceed that age. So it really just shows that all across the country and here in states like Wisconsin, we need to make sure that we're investing our transportation dollars wisely and really just making sure that we are prioritizing the repair and maintenance of our current road and bridge infrastructure. The current climate in the state has shown that the state budget just puts a huge priority on spending our money on roads. So from our perspective, we know is sort of the right policy in that regards is if we're going to be spending money on roads, let's make sure that we are fixing what we have first before undertaking massive new highway or expansion projects that in a lot of cases aren't necessary.
Do you have any information on how much more expensive it would be if we were to wait to repair bridges or if we should do them kind of as we come across bridges that need repair?
It is certainly a lot more expensive if we wait to make repairs until the last possible minute. For example, it's a tragic example to look at, but you go back a few years to the interstate bridge collapse in Minnesota. It would have been a lot cheaper to repair that bridge a few years before it got to that state than it cost certainly to replace that bridge. The fact of the matter is that repair now is certainly going to be less expensive than repair down the road when a bridge is in danger of imminent collapse.
That was In Our Backyard producer Elliot Hack speaking with WISPRIG program associate Kyle Bailey. To see more details on the report, visit www.wisprig.org.
And now for a roundup of more of today's news and brief, it's tonight's Backyard Beat.
To all those Wisconsin workers who feel like they've been squeezed economically, it's not your imagination, it's reality. After adjusting for inflation, the median state income declined 14.5% between 1999 and 2010, which was far more than the national average of 8.9%, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. In Milwaukee, the fall was even more alarming at 22%. The pain is out there, said Timothy Smeeting, director of research on poverty at the UW-Madison. A working-age family is still the middle class. The middle class is just taking a beating.
While the deadlines have passed and Wisconsin's largest public unions, including the Wisconsin State Employees Union and the American Federation of Teachers Wisconsin, are no longer certified by the state, most of Wisconsin's public unions have opted not to recertify, which, under new rules passed by Republicans in the state, have become unwieldy, cumbersome, and nearly impossible. And if they chose to recertify, the gains would have been minimal anyway, since unions can now collectively bargain only for pay increases at the cost of inflation.
This is really alarming. New census figures analyzed by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau show that Walker's pay cuts for state workers hit lower-paid state employees much harder than higher-paid state workers. For example, those making $25,000 a year are taking a 13.3% pay cut, while those making $125,000 a year are taking just a 6.7% pay cut. These cuts, of course, are thanks to Wisconsin retirement system and health insurance cuts put in place this winter by Walker and the Republican-controlled legislature.
State Senator Jim Colbran, a Democrat from Eagle River, released a press release earlier today warning constituents of the new no-exceptions rule instituted by the Wisconsin Department of Health and Human Services, which ends BadgerCare Plus coverage for anyone who is late sending in their monthly premium payment. Adding to the difficulty in paying premiums faced by those on BadgerCare Plus was the increase in cost from $200 a month to $250 a month, which began in August. Colbran says that he has heard from constituents who made payments that were just a couple of days late, whose policies were canceled outright. No questions asked, no exceptions. The plan is supported only by participant premiums, hence the importance of paying on time. Adding to the frustration, after someone is dropped from Badger Care Plus, they cannot get back into the program, which stopped taking applicants last March. Holbrun adds that this one strike and you're out policy is clearly designed to end the program as soon as possible.
And those were today's top stories. The time is 6:47, and you're listening to Handcrafted Local News on WORT 89.9 FM.
Last week, we spoke to you about the terrible financial situation each youth center in Dane County is facing. The Dane County budget, as it stands right now, will stop funding all of its youth centers. So what do youth centers in the community do? Well, here's Daniel, a student from Sun Prairie.
I like it here because it's a fun place to be. There's different activities like video games, sports, basketball or football, and either that or just a fun place to hang out with different kids and people.
Youth centers make up an extremely small amount of Dane County's budget. The budget is about $500 million. Its allocation to the youth centers of Dane County is only about $150,000. This year, it might be zero. Here's Dan Moritz, who manages the Sun Prairie Youth Center.
You know, I try to stay positive in everything I do, but the Dane County's been a real valued partner. They've been consistent with us. They've been there at the start, and the funding amount that they allocate towards our center here is about 20% of our budget. So, you know, that's a sizable amount of money. I mean, if you were to just look at your own personal finances and take 20% out, or, you know, if you just want to kind of think in those terms, that's a difference maker. You know, we're going to have to look at ways to try and make that up. The bottom line is the loss of that money and revenue will impact us.
When you do the math, you realize that these youth centers operate on shoestring budgets, but the return investment is high. Here's a way to think about it. For about $16, the county buys a teen a year-long pass to a youth center, complete with free food, video games, gym time, and plenty of positive enrichment with adults. That is, you know, instead of negative enrichment time spent on the streets. It's considered one of the most economical crime prevention strategies in the county. Many people who spoke at the Dane County budget hearing last week Monday were positive, upbeat, and conciliatory. Amy Mosier-Garvey was upbeat herself, but speaking as a concerned citizen, she called out the board a bit.
This budget is embarrassing to me as a citizen of Dane County. I am disappointed that we cannot get beyond saving people who already have resources a little bit more money at the expense of having people sleep on the floor of a church or not be able to access services. When we talk about not adding $15 to somebody's vehicle registration because that's going to be a burden to them, we have to realize what the consequence is at the other end. This budget does not address inequality in our community.
So about that $15 fee that Mosier-Garvey mentioned, what is that? Well, that's a much-talked-about registration fee, or wheel tax, that the county could impose to make up the budget shortfall. The tax wouldn't go directly to the Department of Human Services, but rather the transportation budget. Then that would free up some general-purpose money for the Department of Human Services. Now, we're going to get into some numbers here, so bear with me. The registration fee is sort of a loophole around Governor Walker's caps on how much a government can increase its budget. The state says Dane County budget can, the state says that the Dane County budget can only be increased $900,000 more than it was last year. That's less than 0.2% of an increase. Of course, expenses have increased at a much higher rate. The result leaves few options: either severe cuts or the county is going to have to get creative. The creative idea of a vehicle registration fee has been around for a little while. Four municipalities already have one: Milwaukee, Beloit, Mayville, and St. Croix County. In Dane County, it would probably be only a stopgap measure, a one-time tax until 2012, when the county would seek a referendum allowing it to increase its human services budget past the cap. However, the idea may already be dead in the water, thanks once again to a heavy-handed state legislature. Representative Dean Knudsen, who is a Republican from Hudson, has proposed a bill requiring a referendum before any registration fee can be implemented. It would essentially kill the wheel tax idea. And that is where the financial situation sits right now. Will the cuts stand? How much DHS funding will be restored? The finalized budget is expected to emerge by the end of this month.
A new report from Tucson-based No More Deaths, NMD, finds that the U.S. Border Patrol systematically deprives immigrant detainees of basic rights, medical care, and food, and that such abuses represent a, quote, culture of cruelty. This culture is fostered by a lack of oversight and accountability for the agency, part of the largest federal law enforcement body in the United States. At a press conference held by NMD yesterday morning, Lila Pines, a Madison humanitarian worker, explained how the policies of the U.S. Border Patrol affect immigrants in Wisconsin.
Most immigrants from Wisconsin and elsewhere in the U.S. are funneled through Arizona during deportation. Therefore, most undocumented immigrants who have spent an average of 14 years living, working, and raising a family in Wisconsin are subjected to many of the human rights violations described in this extensive report if they are deported. They generally have deep roots to family, jobs, and communities in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the U.S.
Pines believes that abuse of immigrants is a systematic problem within the U.S. Border Patrol and the Department of Homeland Security.
Individuals consistently told stories of unsafe detention practices, physical assault, emotional and psychological abuse, including threats of death or sexual abuse, and severe retaliation for attempting to complain. The lack of accountability within DHS and the Border Patrol produce a culture of cruelty wherein individual rights are violated at will with zero recourse for its victims. The problems are systemic and continuous, and the reports of abuse remain alarmingly consistent from year to year, from interviewer to interviewer, and across interview sites. What No More Deaths has uncovered is nothing less than a system-wide reality, starting with the Department of Homeland Security and ending in repetitive cycles of physical, emotional, and psychological abuse by Border Patrol agents.
Tomas Contreras, a Madison businessman who lived legally in the United States for 46 years, also spoke at the press conference. In 2007, he was detained by ICE after visiting his family in Mexico. He was held for 81 days before being released. He describes his conditions, the conditions in which he was incarcerated.
And I was reading these stories here about people that they throw them in places that it's really cold. It's true. They throw you in a room, and they can put the room at 40 degrees, and they don't give you a blanket. And the bed's made out of metal. I was reading this, and it brings me back, and it's true. No, he's seeing guards slapping people around, seeing guards kicking people. I saw a guy once that was bit by a spider, and his face was as big as my eye was over here. And he was crying, pain. And I called attention to the people there, and somebody stopped by and said, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, this person needs medical attention." He said, "Well, here before, if he can't put it up, you put it up for him, and we'll see him in 15 days.
Contreras doesn't think that immigrant abuse is just a recent problem in the United States.
No. Before, everybody was legal, they were beaten up, they were thrown back to their countries. Now, there's people coming like you that you see this, and you let us know that it's not right. But the guards that I have, they've been here for 15, they don't know that. When we start noticing all these abuses, That's when they changed the laws and started throwing people that have been living here for years into these places. That's when we started hearing about the abuses. But the abuses have been there for 50, 60 years. But we didn't know about them. We didn't know about them because everybody was thrown back to their country. They couldn't come back to anybody and tell their stories.
A full copy of the report from No More Deaths can be found at www.cultureofcruelty.org. Also on the site is a petition to President Obama calling for action to correct the abuses detailed in the report.
And this has been a production of In Our Backyard, WRT's independent news, 6:30, Monday through Thursday. Our reporters tonight were Mark Griffin and Patrick Waring. Anthony Rainier was our on-air engineer, and Nick Rainier answered the phones. Elliot Hack was the producer of tonight's program. Special thanks to all of our listeners. I'm Aaron Romans.
And I'm Aaron Sommerfeld. In Our Backyard has immediate openings for reporters. Please give us a call at 256-2001. Stay tuned next for Health Writers. We'll be back in your ears Monday at 6:30. Until then, good night.
Listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's Used Bicycle Showroom, located at 930 Regent Street. The Used Bicycle Showroom offers vintage bicycles from Schwinn, Raleigh, and Peugeot, as well as refurbished bicycles for people of all abilities, including one-speed cruisers, three-speed uprights, and bicycles built for two. 251-1663.
The Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice invites the public to their fall assembly and reception on Saturday, October 8th, at the Pyle Center on the UW-Madison campus. The assembly begins at 11 a.m. and includes lunch and a viewing of the film Keepers of the Water, a discussion, extreme mining in Wisconsin, from Crandon to mountaintop removal on the Pinoki Hills, will be led by Al Geddix. Registration for the assembly and lunch is required. The reception from 2:30 to 5 features Native American activist and author Winona LaDuc speaking on militarism, mining, or living. Wisconsin Senator Fred Ritzer, co-founder of WNPJ, and Fab 14 member will receive the WNPJ Lifetime Achievement Award. There is no fee or registration for the reception, and donations are welcome. To register for the assembly or for information about this event, visit WNPJ.org or call 608-250-9240. Helping you network for peace and justice, this is WORT 89.9 FM in Madison.
So my name is José Beauvais. Listen to Health Writers if you are concerned about the health of the body politic.
Last night in Georgia, a man was murdered. His name was Troy Anthony Davis. He was murdered because in Georgia, there is no such thing as a fair trial for a black man. Not when you can't afford a good lawyer. Not when the police show the witnesses your picture before they do the lineup. Not when it doesn't matter that seven of those witnesses come forward to say that they lied under oath because the police coerced them. Not when it doesn't matter that the first man who fingered Troy Davis then confessed to the crime himself. Not when it doesn't matter that jurors came forward and said if they had known then what they know now, Troy Davis would never have been convicted. Not when it doesn't matter that Troy Davis was innocent. And not when the police celebrated in riot gear outside of his execution chamber. Last night, the whole world was watching. the whole world that again and again has been lectured at by the United States about freedom and democracy. They watched as Troy Davis was strapped down on a gurney with a needle in his arm for 4 hours waiting to decide whether politicians felt like he deserved to live. There is a word for that barbarity, and it is torture.